And then it occurs to me, what if he had a second cell phone I didn't know about? Another life, another wife. The possibility hits me square in the belly, churning to acid in my gut. Before I can chicken out, I punch the digits into my cell and hit send, holding my breath as it rings over my car's hands-free system. Once, twice, again. After the fourth, it flips me to voicemail, a computer-generated voice repeating the number and asking me to leave a message. I hang out before I get to the beep. Now what? I chew my lip, stare out the windshield at people coming and going through the parking lot, and think things through. Maybe the number is nothing but a mistake. But what if it's not? What if it really did belong to Will? A cell phone doesn't come for free. What if I can trace the number? Will it point me to a bank account I didn't know he had? One fat with the stolen AppSec money? My cell phone buzzes between my fingers, and I jump clear out of my seat. My brother. I suck a monster breath, willing my heart to settle, and answer on the hands-free system. Just so you know, you scared the pants off me, and now I have to go back inside the mall to pee.
Just so you know, Mom thinks you've fallen into the Chattahoochee. Wait, what are you doing at the mall? I thought you were meeting Will's boss.
I was. I drop the phone in my cup holder, leaning back into the seat and giving Dave a quick but thorough blow-by-blow of my conversation with Nick. The missing money, Nick's notice of the ring, the way he waited for the words I couldn't choke out. My husband didn't do it. He's innocent. They've lawyered up, Dave. Nick said he'd take Will down if he had to, but he was going after that money.
Of course he is. Nobody just lets somebody run off with $4.5 million, which means you need to be lawyering up, too. You need to make sure none of this blows back on you.
My spine straightens against the leather upholstery. Blow back how? I didn't steal a penny. As I say the words, Nick's warning slides through my mind. He told me he'd take me down, too, in order to recover the money, and a chill skates across my skin.
Maybe not, but if Will used stolen money to buy things you shared, cars, furniture, vacations, those kinds of things, as his wife, you could be held accountable. They could come after you, too.
I unfold my right hand from the steering wheel, the Cartier blinking on my finger. Will paid cash for the ring. A pointed silence fills my car. I drop my forehead to the steering wheel. Give it a few thumps. How did this happen? How did I go from happily married to a widow wearing hocked jewels in just a week?
Now is not the time to be feeling sorry for yourself, Iris. Now is the time to find and retain the best lawyer in town.
My thoughts zip to Evan Sheffield, the 7-foot attorney I met at the memorial, the one who lost his wife and baby daughter in the crash. I think of him and his shoulders, heavy with burden, and the feelings come flooding back. The shock, the fury, the grief. I imagine myself sitting across from him, looking into his sad eyes as I tell him about the missing $4.5 million, and the idea makes me dizzy with dread. I'll make some calls today, I say, lifting my head to find a valet standing in front of my car, watching me with concern. I give him a weak smile to let him know I'm all right, and he jogs off. In the meantime, do me a favor, will you? Don't tell Mom and Dad about this, okay? Dad already threatened to pay for the alarm system, and I don't want them to worry any more than they already are.
Are you sure that's a good idea?
Dave says, right as a text pings my phone.
You can't.
Dave's still talking. But I'm no longer listening. I'm staring at a text from the 678 phone. Hello, Iris. How did you get this number? My stomach flips upside down. With shaking fingers, I type my answer. How do you know my name? Who is this? A bubble appears under my message, indicating the other person is typing. I hold my breath and wait for the answer.
Hello? Dave says over the car speakers. Iris, are you still there? I mash the button on my steering wheel to end the call, my gaze never leaving the phone. A few seconds later, a text lights up my screen. There was only one other person who knew this number, and he is dead. Do you have what he took from me? Nausea rises in my throat. Whoever is on the other end is referring to the money. A partner? Me. I'm not answering any questions until you tell me who you are. 678-555-8214. This isn't a negotiation. I want my money. Me. What money? 678-555-8214. Tell me where Will hid the money, or you'll be joining him. I take the long way home, winding down Lennox Road in a daze, my phone on the passenger side floor, where I flung it like a hot potato. I barely notice when the stately condos and perfectly manicured lawns give way to a seedier strip, dark-windowed lingerie shops and gentlemen's clubs of Cheshire Bridge. I putter past in the slow lane, stuck behind slow-moving out-of-towners and MARTA buses making frequent stops, fingers gripping the wheel hard enough to snap it in two. I've never been at the receiving end of a death threat before, even though it was delivered in the most impersonal way possible, via text and from who knows how many miles away. The words still hit me like an icy fist in my gut. Tell me where Will hid the money, or you'll be joining him. At the light, I lean over the middle console and check my cell. Still dark and silent, thank God. Whoever the person is on the other end of that 678, I don't doubt for a second that their threat was serious. This person knows Will, knows about the 4.5 million, and thinks I know where Will put it. People have killed for a whole lot less. Two questions enter my mind at once. First, how did the sender know it was me? This person must have already had my cell phone number. But how? Second, if the number wasn't Will's, why would he have given it to Natasha? Why list it on the receipt of something bought with stolen money? The car behind me beeps, and I look up to see the light has turned green. I leave my phone on the floorboard and hit the gas, falling into line behind a white SUV. And then another thought makes my hands wrap tighter around the wheel. Could the blocked number and the 678 number be owned by the same person? I roll that one around in my mind, poking and prodding for holes. The Best Buy geek said the Seattle texts, the ones that showed up as a blocked number on my phone, were sent from a messaging app and therefore couldn't be traced. What if the 678 phone has the messaging app on it? It's entirely possible they originated from the same cell phone. I take a ride on North Highland and follow the two-lane road through the heart of Virginia Highlands. By now it's close to 6, and the streets and sidewalks are crammed with rush hour and dinner traffic. I creep along, trying to convince myself the senders are the same. But I can't. The tone of the texts was too different, the messages too contrasting. I swerve into a parking lot and dig my phone off the floor, pulling up the text string from the blocked number. Compared to the threat from the 678 number, these texts seem almost innocuous, urging me to go home, to not believe what I was hearing about Will from the folks at Rainier Vista. Like, whoever it was didn't want me to find out the truth about Will. I think about who would want to keep me in the dark about Will's past, who would have something to lose or gain if I found out. And the only person I can come up with is Will. Will didn't want me to know, enough so that he lied about his parents, his background, his ties to Rainier Vista and Seattle. Will is the most likely person to have sent those texts, which is, of course, impossible. A dead man can't send a text. And then Corbin's words filter through my brain. The ones Will made him swear on his mother's grave. I promised that if anything ever happened to him, I'd look out for you. Is Corbin the person behind the blocked number? An anonymous protector, fulfilling his promise to a dead friend? I let the possibility sink into my brain, but something about it doesn't feel right. Something doesn't quite pass the smell test. And then it hits me. Corbin didn't know about Will's past in Seattle, either. He was just as stunned as I'd been when I found out. Either that, or the man is a world-class actor. Frustration burns across my chest, and I shove my car into reverse, swinging it around and punching the gas for the road home. Do I get help? Contact the police and have them trace the 678 number? Maybe I should tell them about Nick threatening to take me down in order to get back the money. Maybe Nick is the one behind the text. But what if Dave is right? I could be held accountable. And they might try to take the ring. I splay my fingers on the wheel, and the diamonds flash in the sunlight coming through the front windshield. I picture myself rolling it off my finger and dropping it into an evidence bag, and a panicky feeling rises in my throat. I remember Will's soft smile when he put it there, on the morning of the day he died, and my hand tightens into a fist. They'll have to cut my finger off to get it. I have an antiquated system. This is what the alarm guy, a pot-bellied man who tells me to call him Big Jim, says as soon as I walk through the front door. Something about my panels and motion sensors being far too basic for the newer technology, which nowadays works via GSM rather than hardwired telephone lines. He tells me all this in a rambling, roundabout way, using far too many words for the message he's trying to convey. I interrupt him halfway to nowhere, softening my words with a smile. Is there a price in there somewhere? The grin Big Jim gives me in return is big and wide, revealing teeth as crooked as they are yellow.
There's a price in there, but I was just working up to it gentle-like, so as not to scare you off.
It's like pulling off a Band-Aid. Just say it really fast and get it over with. It's less painful that way.
$600.
He hands me a handwritten proposal, tapping his mouth with a pen.
That's to install all new equipment, add glass breaks to the room on the ground floor, replace your old panels, and add another one to your bedroom wall, all of which will qualify your system for our basic package.
My cell phone feels hot in my pocket, the threatening words flashing across my mind. Tell me where Will hid the money, or you'll be joining him. How much for your Mac Daddy system? I say. One of Big Jim's bushy eyebrows rises up his forehead.
You talking cameras and two-way voice intercoms and panic buttons?
Is that the best you've got?
Yes, ma'am. Top of the line. Also comes with a video monitoring system you can control from your phone or computer.
Sold.
But I haven't told you the price.
Whatever it is, I'll pay it. And if you install everything today, it comes with the added bonus of a home-cooked meal and a hefty tip. From the smell of things, my money's on spaghetti. I give him a this-is-your-lucky-day smile. Mom's meatballs are world-class. He leans back on his heels and cackles.
It's a deal.
I leave him to his work and head down the hallway into the kitchen, where Mom is at the stove, stirring a pot large enough to feed the whole block. She hears me dump my bag on the counter and tosses me a smile over her shoulder. Hi, sweetheart. You're just in time. Dinner will be ready in 15. Perfect. I drop a kiss on her cheek, getting a good whiff of tomatoes and garlic and spices, and my stomach growls. At the same time, nausea twists it in a knot. Hope you don't mind, but I just offered to feed the alarm guy. Mom's face brightens. There's nothing she loves more than sharing her cooking with appreciative strangers, and everything about Big Jim says he appreciates a lot of food. She wipes her hands on her apron and moves to a cutting board on the island, setting to work on a cucumber for the salad. Where have you been all afternoon? I thought you were just running out for an hour or so. Oh, I went to run a few quick errands, But you know how Atlanta traffic is. Rush hour starts at 4 o'clock some days. It took me forever to make it back. I flip on the water and wash my hands. What can I do to help? She points the end of the knife at a bowl full of shallots. Slice up one of those, will you? Mom begins chatting about her ideas for the funeral, listing off a couple of venues she wants to check out, and relief loosens the muscles knotted across my shoulders. Either Mom didn't notice I was being intentionally vague, or she decided not to push it. But I meant what I said to Dave. Until I know how airtight Nick's allegations are, I'm not planning to fill my parents in on the missing $4.5 million. They're already worried enough, and adding death threats and the possibility of criminal charges into the mix will send them into nuclear territory. But a bigger reason, and yes, after the events of these past few days, I can see how some might call it an irrational reason as well, is that I don't want to further tarnish their memory of Will. My parents have always loved Will, and for the exact same reasons that Dave did, because of how plainly and perfectly Will loved me. The thought of watching their expressions turn sour, of seeing judgment flash across their faces every time his name is brought up at Christmases and birthdays, makes my stomach feel heavy, like there's a rock lodged at the very bottom. Dave comes through the back door with his iPad and a bottle of beer, his designer sunglasses hanging from the neck of his polo shirt.
Why'd you hang up on me?
The great thing about having a twin is that you're so in sync, and they know what you're thinking without you having to say a word. Until you've got a secret, that is. And then, the worst thing about having a twin is that you're so in sync. The problem is, I know Dave, and I know if I tell him about the death threat, he'll glue himself to my side and never leave. As much as I love my brother, the thought of his constant hovering makes me hot and itchy, my skin stretched too tight. I didn't hang up on you, I lie. We must have gotten cut off or something. He narrows his eyes.
Then why didn't you call me back?
Our conversation was already winding down. What else was there to say? Besides, I was on my way home. I figured we could finish up in person. I pluck a bottle of water from the fridge and turn to face him. Like now, for example. Let's finish now. My cell phone buzzes in my pocket, vibrating the skin of my hip and spiking both my pulse and my body temperature. I unzip my hoodie and peel it off, dropping it onto the counter next to my bag. He cocks his head and studies me, his gaze crawling over my face.
What is up with you? Why are you purple? What are you not telling me?
Nothing, Dave. I'm not telling you nothing. He throws his hands up in the air by his sides.
That doesn't make any sense.
Exactly, and neither does this conversation. Mom's sigh is one I've heard a million times before. What sounds like an argument to her is just Dave's and my normal way of communicating, except for now. Now we're fussing because he's trying to unpuzzle my secret, and I'm holding the missing piece in my pocket.
I swear, you two are worse than a couple of toddlers.
She shoves a stack of plates into Dave's hands.
Set the table, would you?
He gives me an I'm watching you look, then heads toward the table. As soon as his back is turned, I slide the phone from my pocket. 678-555-8214. FYI, I know how to get around an alarm system. Unknown.
Why the alarm, Iris? Did something happen?
Chapter 21. All through dinner, the phone is like a hunk of plutonium pressed against my hip, a silent and deadly thing, radiating poison in my pocket. If I had any doubts before that the numbers came from different sources, I certainly don't now. There's no way I know how to get around an alarm system and did something happen came from the same thumbs, unless it's someone trying to mess with my mind. The thought sours my stomach, churning the spaghetti and meatballs I just choked down into a nauseating mush, because it's entirely possible. Maybe even the same person who sent the letter in my husband's hand,
which my training tells me could only have come from a sociopath.
Iris, sweetheart, did you hear a word we said? Mom says from across the table.
I freeze my fork mid-spaghetti twirl, look up from my plate to find her watching me, her brow furrowed with concern.
I'm sorry, what?
We were just talking about our plans, and how James needs to head home this weekend. He confirms this with an apologetic smile.
I have a full day of surgery on Monday, and I really need a day or two at home to get my bearings. I hope you understand.
You don't have to apologize for having your own life and career. Go. Of course, go. I'll be fine.
I'll come back next weekend, and we'll see where we're at.
He says this to the table, but mostly to Dave. And that's when it dawns on me that James is planning to return to Savannah alone. He's leaving my brother here. I look around at my family, wonder what else of their conversation I missed.
What are everybody else's plans?
We're staying, they say, pretty much in unison.
Don't you have to get back to work? I say to my parents, then turn to Dave. What about your career? Don't you have showings next week?
I'll get a colleague to handle them.
He lifts a shoulder like, no biggie, but I happen to know he's full of crap. Real estate is a tough business, and the sharks in his office are notoriously bloodthirsty, always nipping at other agents' clients. Guilt nips at my insides. My gaze goes to Mom, then Dad, both of whom are conspicuously silent. I see a million things in the way they look at me. Worry, determination, stubbornness. They've no plans to leave this weekend either. In fact, Mom looks ready to chain herself to the chair and bolt it to the floor.
You guys really don't have to stay. I'll be fine.
Mom looks insulted I would even suggest it, and she's shaking her head before I finish speaking.
Your father and I have already cleared it at work, and we want to stay. We're happy to, and for as long as you need us.
A warm wave of love for my sweet mom washes up my chest. If she had her way, she'd be moving in and force-feeding me 3 square meals a day until I'm ready to start dating again. Is it weird that I want some time alone? I'm not an introvert. I love my family, and I normally wish they lived closer. New widows usually dread this moment, when the people pack up their things and return to their own lives, leaving the widow alone with her grief. And here I am, trying to talk my family into it. I put down my fork and say it as gently as I know how. I love having you here. And as much as I appreciate the 4 of you gathering around me this past week, and I really do, I'm not going to be around much. I'm going back to work Monday morning. Mom's brows dip under the weight of her worry.
So soon?
I nod. It's what I would tell myself to do if I were my own patient, to get back to my normal life and routine, to carve out a new normal for myself. And honestly, I'm kind of looking forward to being around kids who are even more screwed up than I am. It might take some of the edge off. When she doesn't crack the slightest smile at my joke, I reach across the table and cover her hand with mine.
Mom, I know what I'm doing. I promise.
She darts a look at Dad, who gives her an up-to-you shrug. She shakes her head, her stubborn expression digging in even further.
I don't like the idea of you being alone.
I'll meet Elizabeth for dinner, or invite her over for a drink. I haven't seen or talked to her, to any of my girlfriends, since the memorial. It'll be good.
That's a great idea. You do whatever you need to do, Mom says. I'll keep working on the funeral plans. And now that it's warming up, your window boxes could use some refreshing.
I try for a compromise.
Why don't you go home for a few days, take care of whatever you need to take care of there, then come back later in the week. We'll have the whole weekend together.
I have a better idea,
Dave says, as usual, wading in to save me.
Why don't we all meet at Mom and Dad's next weekend instead? It's closer for us, and Mom and Dad won't have to make the drive again.
I give an enthusiastic nod.
Honestly, I wouldn't mind getting out of town for a bit.
I don't know, she hedges. Jules, she'll be fine,
Dad says, tossing me a wink.
Won't you, Pumpkin?
Absolutely. And I'll leave straight from school on Friday to put me there by dinner time. Outnumbered and outmaneuvered, Mom reluctantly agrees, and Dad steers the conversation to weekend plans. There's a new barbecue restaurant in town he's been dying to try, and maybe we could all go see a movie at the new Cineplex, one where they serve wine and have big chairs that recline like lazy boys. I smile and hum like I love the idea, but meanwhile, I'm counting the moments until I'm alone. There's something I need to do, and I can't do it with any of them here. After dinner, I dig a blank check and $100 tip for Big Jim from my bag, hand both to Dad, and head upstairs. The adrenaline that's carried me all day is long depleted, and exhaustion pushes down on me like a lead blanket. Big Jim is hunched on the floor just inside my bedroom door, packing up his toolbox. I trip over his industrial boot.
"Whoa there,"
he says, steadying me with a palm around my wrist.
"Won't do anybody any good with broken bones."
I don't tell him there's nobody but me now, or that a broken bone hurts a hell of a lot less than a broken heart. I brush myself off and tell him I'm fine. A brand new alarm panel hangs on the wall above his head.
"I was just about to call you up here."
He pushes to a stand and dusts his hands on the seat of his pants.
"You got a minute or two for me to give you the highlights?"
My eyes are burning, my brain is blurry, and my body aches to climb under my covers, but I nod anyway. "Explain away."
"Okay. For now, I've set your system to a default code, but as soon as I'm done here, you should change it to one of your own. You'll use the code to turn the system on and off, as well as make any changes to the panel settings. So make sure it's a combination you know by heart. And see these three buttons here?"
He points to a vertical row of squares, universal symbols for police, fire, and ambulance.
"These here are your panic buttons. There's another two by your bed, tucked behind each of your nightstands. You gotta hold them in for a minimum of 3 seconds, and make sure you mean it, because we show up with guns blazing, no questions asked. If it turns out to be a false alarm, you'll be getting a big old bill."
"Got it."
"Good. Now, your duress code is set to straight down the middle of the keypad, 2580. That's another one you'll want to change to your own as soon as I'm done."
Why would I use a duress code instead of a panic button?
"In case somebody's holding a gun to your head and watching over your shoulder while you disarm the system."
My eyes blow wide. "That actually happens?" Big Jim nods, his fleshy jowls bobbing.
"Just happened to a young couple in Buckhead. Two armed men surprised the husband as he was coming in from the garage. Pistol whipped them both until they forked over all their cash and valuables. Husband used the duress code. Otherwise, they'd probably both be dead."
"Jesus." I haul a calming breath, but it doesn't work. The idea of someone chasing me into my own home, pistol-whipping me until I fork over $4.5 million I don't have, sends an army of ants crawling under my skin. He points to an 800 number on the inside cover of the keypad.
"Call this number first thing after I'm gone, and set up your code word. It's an added security measure, and our operators will ask for it every time they call. If the bad guy is standing next to you, give him the wrong word, and that's their signal to send in the cavalry. Don't worry if you forget any of this. It's all explained in detail in the owner's manual, which I'll get you before I leave."
"Give it to my father, will you? He's got your payment, and Mom's holding dinner for you downstairs whenever you're ready." Big Jim pats his gut and grins.
"I'm pretty much always ready."
After he's gone, I toe out of my sneakers, dig my cell phone out of my pocket, and collapse onto my bed. There are no new texts, nothing from either number, and I don't know whether to feel relieved or disappointed. Both, maybe. Relief for the one, disappointment for the other. I pull up the string with the 678 number,
the one ending in two threats. Tell me where Will hid the money, or you'll be joining him. FYI, I know how to get around an alarm system. No way I'm touching either one of those. I back up, click on the conversation with the blocked number. Why the alarm, Iris? Did something happen? I think about who would be worried about me, besides the people cleaning my kitchen downstairs. My colleagues, my girlfriends, the friendly neighbors to our left and across the street. None of them would text me from a blocked number. I press my fingers to my eyes and rub. Maybe I'm too tired, stressed, wrecked, and confused from lying in the bed I once shared with Will. None of this makes any sense. Before I can think through the pros and cons of engaging whoever is on the other end of the blocked number, my thumbs start typing. Why do you care? Who are you? The reply pings my screen 2 seconds later, as if whoever is on the other end has been waiting for me all this time, thumbs pressed to the screen. I'm a friend, and I want you to be safe. Tell me who's after you and why. I want to help. Me. Don't play games with me. If you knew I was in Seattle and got an alarm, you know about the stolen money, too. Unknown. I know about the money. I just wasn't sure you did. My heart rides into my throat as I type the next words. Me. Are you the one who stole it? Unknown. That depends on who you believe. The last text comes with a whip-like lash. So far, the only theory I've heard for who took the money is Will, which means... not possible. A dead man can't send texts. I'm considering my next move when another text lights up my screen. Unknown. Please tell me what I can do to help you. Me. I don't think so. Not until you tell me who you are. Unknown. I want nothing more. Believe me. But it's better for both of us if I remain anonymous. Me. Then what's the point? Why bother texting me at all? Unknown. Because it's the next best thing to actually being there. Chapter 22. The law offices of Rogers, Sheffield, and Shea are located in the heart of Midtown, high in the clouds looming over Peachtree Street. Their lobby is everything you'd expect from Atlanta's most prestigious attorney firm. Modern furnishings, seamless glass walls providing sweeping views of downtown, and a 20-foot track to a dark-haired receptionist who could moonlight as a model. Iris Griffith, here to see Evan Sheffield? She gestures to a row of leather chairs by the window. His assistant will be right out. In the meantime, may I get you something to drink? I'd love water, thanks. What I'd really love is to get the hell out of here. To take the elevator back down to the parking deck, make a dash for my car, and gun the gas for home. It's not so much that I'm dreading what I'm here to tell him, though admitting my husband is a liar and a thief is certainly bad enough. No, my urge to beat a retreat is more fueled by fear. The last time I saw Evan, his eyes were haunted, and they've haunted me ever since. His assistant leads me into his corner office, where Evan is seated at a round table by the far wall. He's grown a beard since I've seen him last, a scruffy patch of dirty blonde fur that sprouts from the lower half of his face, either a bold middle finger to the corporate world, or a testament that the weight of his grief is too heavy a load to bear. I lift a hand. Hi, Evan. His suit jacket is folded over the chair beside him, his sleeves rolled up to just under his elbows. It's an attempt at looking relaxed, but it doesn't work. His back is slumped, his shoulders hunched, and his face, when it spreads into a sorry excuse for a smile, looks bruised and battered. He unfolds his massive body from his chair and reaches a long arm across the table, shaking mine above a bucket of ice and a tray of every brand of bottled water imaginable.
Good to see you again, Iris. I'd ask how you're holding up, but I hate that question. And besides, I'm pretty sure I already know.
Of course he knows. He He knows that the hole Liberty Air blew into his life is permanent, as is that hollow place inside him. He knows how you can lose hours at a time, staring into space, and torturing yourself with an endless parade of what-if scenarios. What if she'd gotten stuck in traffic? What if she'd given up her seat for that $500 coupon airlines are always using as enticement for overbooked flights? What if, what if, what if? He knows these things, so no need to say them out loud. "Thanks for seeing me on such short notice," I say instead. "I know you had to shuffle some things around." He waves off my thanks.
"You're the psychologist. Is it weird that I wanted to see you?"
I sink into a chair diagonal from him, his blunt honesty loosening some of the knots across my shoulders. "Funny, I was just wondering how weird it would be if I hightailed it for the car."
"Is it my quick wit and sparkling personality?"
He pushes up a self-deprecating smile, gestures to his massive frame.
"My Herman Munster build and He-Man charm?"
"It's your eyes, actually." I brace and look at them full on, and they're just as awful as I remembered. A beautiful mossy green, but they're red around the rims, and the surrounding skin is puffy and crisscrossed with lines I happen to know are from despair. "Looking at them hurts my heart." He winces, but he doesn't let go of my gaze.
"No more than looking into yours hurts mine."
"You must be a sucker for punishment, then." He puffs a laugh devoid of humor.
"It's all relative these days, isn't it?"
There's really nothing to say to that, so I don't say anything at all. I stare out the window instead, watching a pair of hawks swoop and dive against fluffy white clouds. While Dave and I were chasing Will's past around Seattle, a group of 30 or so people boarded a private Liberty Airlines jet and traveled to the crash site. I saw the images on Huffington Post, Evan's profile standing taller than the blackened stalks, solemn figures holding hands and hugging in a charred field soaked with the essence of those they lost. I saw them, and I thought, I can't. What does it say about me, a psychologist for crap's sake, that they could and I can't?
"One of the lessons I've learned this past week," Evan says, his voice bringing me back, "is that nobody understands what you and I are going through. People think that they do, and a lot of them want to understand, but they don't. Not really. Unless they've lost someone like you and I have, they can't."
Grief wells up like a sudden tide, intense and overwhelming. Evan has just hit on a big part of why grief groups are so popular. We're strangers on the same boat, both trapped in a sinkhole of sorrow. At the very least, it helps to know you're not going under alone. "It's not just losing Will. It's..." I pause, searching for the right word. But either Evan's already thought this through, or his brain is much quicker than mine.
"It's the horror of how."
My nod is immediate. "Exactly. It's the horror of how. It's where I go whenever I close my eyes. I see his tears. I hear his screams. His terror beats in my chest. It's like I can't stop replaying those awful last minutes, putting myself in his shoes, while the plane flipped and swerved and fell from the sky." I say the words, and boom, I'm crying. This is why I didn't want to come. Why no force on the planet could have made me step onto that cornfield. Whoever said God doesn't give you more than you can handle was full of shit, because this grief that slams me over and over like a Mack truck, this weight of missing Will that presses down on all sides until I can't breathe, is going to kill me. Evan pushes a box of Kleenex across the table.
"I keep forgetting this is my new life. I'll be halfway through leaving a message on Susanna's voicemail, or standing in my boxers in my daughter's room in the middle of the night, her warm bottle in my hand, before I remember. The crib is empty. My wife and baby daughter are dead.
Jesus, Evan,
I say, my voice cracking. I pluck a tissue from the box and swipe it across my cheeks.
A couple days ago, I got a call from some journalist claiming the pilot was sleep-deprived and possibly hungover. Something about a
bachelor party. I know. I've got somebody in Miami right now, asking around. So far, though, nothing.
Has he talked to Tiffany Rivero?
Who?
I give Evan a quick rundown of my conversations with Leslie Thomas, and he goes completely still. His expression doesn't change. If it weren't for the purple flush pushing out from under his shirt collar, I'd think he hadn't heard me.
The story hasn't broken yet, so she might be...
He pounds a fist on the table, rattling the ice in the bucket.
I knew it! I knew these fuckers were hiding something! A plane doesn't just fall from the sky unless...
He pauses to pant, three quick breaths that flutter the papers on the table.
If this is true, if there was even a whiff of misconduct by anyone inside that cockpit, I will make it my personal mission to take down that airline and everybody in it. I guarantee you that much.
The psychologist in me says revenge won't change anything. Your wife and baby girl, my will, they'll all still be dead.
What does the widow say?
I don't have to think about my answer, not even for a second.
The widow in me says obliterate the bastards.
Done. I'll talk to Tiffany personally. Fly there myself if I have to.
He scrubs a hand down his face, and his fury dissipates as quickly as it came, morphing into sorrow.
God help me. If my girls died because some asshole was too cocky to call in sick...
At the mention of his family, he looks on the verge of tears again, and I know how he feels, like his emotions have multiple personality disorder. Why do they call it grief, when really it's a whole gamut of awful emotions, confusion and regret and anger and guilt and loneliness, wrapped up into one little word?
I can't keep food down,
I hear myself say. Evan's honesty has loosened something up in me, and the words come out on their own accord.
Everything tastes like cardboard, even when I'm starving. I'll eat it, then throw it right back up. And every time I'm hanging over the toilet, puking up my guts, I get this secret little thrill, because I think maybe I'm pregnant.
I take it you and Will were trying.
I nod, but not for very long. So the odds aren't exactly in my favor.
The nausea is probably psychosomatic or wishful thinking or just plain old heartbreak. I don't know.
But I can't help from thinking that if I had a baby, if I had this little nugget of my husband growing inside me, it would make things a little easier.
I think it would make things a lot easier. Then you'd feel like you had something to live for.
His words trigger a warning in my psychologist's brain.
Are you saying you don't?
I'm saying it's awfully hard to remember that I do sometimes. Especially at 4 a.m. when I'm standing in my daughter's dark, empty room, staring into her empty crib, while her cries echo in my head.
A surge of sadness for this man jabs me in the center of the chest. Telling me that even though my own heart may be broken to bits, things could be worse.
I reach across the table, give his big hand a squeeze. The gesture is empathy, sympathy, and solidarity, all at the same time. He pulls his hand out of mine and drops his head into both of his, blowing a long breath out through his fingers.
I'm sorry. You didn't come all the way here to have me cry on your shoulder.
He looks up. His mask molded into something semi-professional.
You said something about needing some legal advice. Does it have anything to do with the crash?
No. Yes. Well, sort of. But in a Twilight Zone sort of way.
I force a laugh, but it comes out loud and abrupt like a sneeze. I follow Evan's lead and become serious.
I need to know if I can be held accountable for my husband's alleged crimes.
His face remains carefully blank.
What kind of crimes are we talking about here?
Embezzlement, mostly.
Mostly, huh?
He fills two glasses with ice and pushes one my way, offering me one of the dozen bottles of water. I select a can of Perrier, and he pops it open with a hiss.
This sounds like the part where I should warn you our attorney-client confidentiality doesn't kick in until you pay me a retainer.
I'm about to ask him if he's serious. I always assumed that was a Hollywood plot device, when he adds,
If we were in a bar, I'd say, buy me a beer. But since we're not, a couple of bucks will do.
I dig five singles from my wallet and slide them across the table.
Start at the beginning,
Evan says, pocketing the cash.
So I do.
I tell Evan everything, beginning with the morning of the crash. I tell him about the Orlando conference and the job that wasn't in Seattle. I tell him about how a condolence card led me to Coach Miller and Rainier Vista and the fire. I tell him about the I'm so sorry letter and my coffee with Corbin and the fact Will asked him to look after me. I tell him about my Beltline stroll with Nick and how a forensic accountant is ferreting through AppSec's books as we speak, in search of the missing $4.5 million. I tell him about the Cartier ring and the text from both the blocked and the 678 number, and how the threats prompted me to install a brand new Mac Daddy alarm system. It's a tremendous relief to finally tell somebody, and the words flow without effort, without hesitation. Evan takes them all in with a serious but stony expression, and without scribbling a single word onto his yellow legal pad. When I'm done, he pushes the pad aside and leans on the table with both forearms.
Okay, so first things first. Liberty Air released Will's name before contacting you?
Yes, only by half an hour or so, but long enough my mom called me before they did.
What a bunch of incompetent morons.
He shakes his head, and a scowl screws up his face.
You know you can name your price now, right? If you threaten to take their blunder to the press, they'll pay you any amount you want, just to keep you quiet.
Anne Margaret Myers' face flashes across my mind, her mask of exaggerated empathy at the Family Assistance Center, when she pushed the check for $54,000 across the desk, her smug-ass smile when she told me there would be more coming.
I don't want anything from them, least of all their blood money. You say that now, but what about a couple of months down the road, when the bills are piling up and your bank account is down by one salary? What if you are pregnant? You're going to need every penny.
No, I won't. I found Will's life insurance policies a couple of days ago. There are three, and for a total of $2.5 million. Financially, I'll be fine. Evan cocks his head.
Are you telling me you didn't know he had those policies?
I only knew about one, the smallest one. The other two he bought without telling me.
Why do you think he did that? And why for so much? The national average for someone in his shoes, married, no kids, is less than half that amount.
I lift my shoulders up to my ears.
I never thought he'd steal or commit arson either, so your guess is as good as mine. Murder.
What?
If he was the one who set the fire that killed his mother and those two kids, then technically he committed murder.
A chill shimmies its way down my spine. Evan takes a long pull from his glass, then crunches on a chunk of ice.
Okay, so we've got a couple of things going on here. If his boss is able to prove Will's the one behind the embezzlement, he can come after you now, but only if Will used any of that money to pay for things you own together. Georgia is an equitable property state, which means if any of those funds benefited you in any way, AppSec can and will hold you accountable for restitution, maybe even fines. They're going to come after the ring, for sure.
I roll the Cartier as far as it will go up my finger, squeeze my hand into a fist.
Will gave it to me the day he died. They'll have to chop off my finger to get it. I'll make sure they don't have to, though more than likely you'll have to fork up the cash to cover the cost. And if they find out about the $2.5 million insurance payout, They'll come after that, too.
They can do that?
I didn't say they'd get it, only that they'd try. And I know it doesn't feel like it, but in terms of your liability and the embezzlement charges, this hidden past angle is a good thing. We can use it to demonstrate there were a lot of secrets in your marriage. Parts of your husband you weren't privy to. His past life in Seattle, the father-in-law you never knew about. All these things are going to work in our favor.
He gives me a few moments to digest this news, filling the silence by refilling both of our waters.
Okay, let's move on to the texts. Did you report them to the police?
Not yet. I wanted to talk to you first.
As much as I applaud your waiting, you wouldn't believe how many convictions I've nailed because some idiot didn't think to consult his attorney first.
You've been physically threatened now, twice.
From someone who wants money I didn't steal and don't have access to.
Won't the police have lots of questions?
Oh, you can count on it, especially if Will's boss has started up an investigation already. But Iris, as your lawyer, I do have to ask. Have you told me everything I need to know? I can't help you unless I know all the facts, and I hate walking into anywhere blind.
Yes, of course. I don't have anything to lie about. Honestly, I've told you everything I can remember. A niggle of guilt pings me between the ribs, and I look away before he sees. There is one thing I haven't told him. One thing I don't dare say out loud. It's too far-fetched, and it will make me sound too crazy.
In that case,
he slaps both palms to the table, pushes to a stand, and flicks his head at the door.
Let's go.
Go where?
To the police station, to file a report.
What now? He gives me a crooked grin. It's tight and it's forced, but I catch a whiff of the old, playful Evan, before plane crashes and empty cribs sucked the joy out of life.
I won't charge you extra, I promise.
Evan drives us to the station closest to my home, a gray stone building on Hosea Williams Drive, one that seems much too small to be serving a city of more than 6 million. The inside is like a public bathroom, crowded and dingy and reeking of industrial-strength cleaner mixed with body odor and the stench of fear. Men in rumpled clothes line the lobby's right wall bench, their wrists cuffed to a metal bar. Their oily gazes slide over me, and I shuffle a little closer to Evan. The desk sergeant, a grizzly-haired man, easily in his 60s, greets Evan by name. The acknowledgement is courteous, but not the least bit friendly, despite Evan's easygoing manner. He leans an elbow on the desk like it's a bar, explaining the situation and requesting an aggravated harassment form in a tone that makes it sound like the sergeant is an old drinking buddy. The man passes Evan the form without comment.
He doesn't seem very nice,
I whisper behind the paper as Evan and I are sinking into a row of empty chairs by the far wall.
That's because he hates my guts.
Evan doesn't bother lowering his voice. He leans back in the chair, crossing an ankle over his knee, and bounces a so-what shoulder.
I'm a defense attorney. I make my living defending the same person his buddies just went to a great deal of trouble to arrest. From where he's sitting, I'm batting for the wrong team.
The sergeant purses his lips and nods, but he doesn't look over.
How am I the wrong team? I say, stung. I didn't do anything.
It'll be fine. Just fill that thing in so we can go make our statement.
I return to the form, and 10 minutes later, we're stepping back up to the front desk.
Detective Driesch in?
Evan says. The sergeant doesn't look up from his papers.
Nope. What about Detective Willoughby?
His pen stills against the paper, and after a great sigh, he leans back in his chair, cranes his neck around the corner.
Detective Johnson's available.
Evan frowns.
Is he new? He's a she, and yep, fresh from patrol. Excellent,
Evan says, but in a tone that makes it obvious it's not.
Wait over there.
The desk sergeant aims his pen over our heads, at the row of chairs we just came from, and Evan and I return to our seats.
It's a full 40 minutes later by the time he shows us to Detective Johnson, a petite officer with a freshly scrubbed face and pretty features pulled high and tight in a ponytail. Her posture is rigid and her expression overly serious, a young woman with something to prove and a glass ceiling to bust through. She gestures for us to sit at the edge of her immaculate desk, an anomaly in this cluttered, crowded room, where most horizontal surfaces seem to be hidden under piles of paper files and dirty coffee mugs. She studies my form, looking up with a knitted brow. Who's the perpetrator?
We're hoping you could tell us that from the cell phone number,
Evan says, before I can draw a breath to answer. Not for the first time, I think how glad I am he didn't send me here alone. I've never done this before, never even had a reason to walk into a police building until Seattle. And now, here I am, for the second time in a week. I feel completely unequipped for this task. Assuming it's not a dump phone, Detective Johnson says. She flips through the copies of the screenshots Evan's assistant printed out, the ones detailing my text conversation with the 678 number. When she gets to the one with the first threat, tell me where Will hid the money or you'll be joining him, she looks up. What money?
$4.5 million in missing funds, allegedly stolen by Mrs. Griffith's husband from his place of employment.
She glances at me, but directs her question at Evan.
Where is the husband now?
He was a passenger on Liberty Airlines Flight 23. Mrs. Griffith is a widow.
The detective's eyes widen, but as far as I can tell, not in sympathy.
So then, where's the money?
My client only learned of the alleged embezzlement yesterday. She's not apprised of where her husband might have stored the funds before his death. It's certainly not in any of their shared accounts. We can confirm all of this with bank statements, of course.
Detective Johnson leans back in her seat, suddenly a lot more interested.
So, let me get this straight. Mr. Griffith embezzles millions,
allegedly, Evan interrupts. As far as I know, no formal charges have been brought.
She gives him an unamused look.
Mr. Griffith allegedly takes off with more than $4 million, then disappears in a plane crash.
He didn't disappear,
Evan says, both his words and tone careful.
He died, and in about the worst possible way you can imagine.
Meanwhile, the money's disappeared too.
Beside me, Evan grows an inch in his chair.
I don't like what you're insinuating, Detective. Mrs. Griffith lost her husband last week, along with 178 other families who lost husbands, wives, parents, and children. Surely you can't be accusing him of what I think you are.
But of course, Evan knows exactly what she's accusing Will of.
And so do I.
My heart takes off, fluttering like a bird trapped behind my ribs, because I know too. It's the same thing I've spent the better part of the past 9 days obsessing over. I've come at it from every possible angle, come up with every possibility, and every time, one answer keeps rising to the top like cream. Evan reads it on my face. He doesn't say a word, but the look he gives me does. It orders me to shut the hell up, to keep whatever I'm thinking to myself.
I'm not accusing anyone of anything, sir. I'm only trying to get a thorough understanding of the situation, so I know what steps we need to take in order to ensure Mrs. Griffith's safety.
She turns back to me.
I'd like to hear it from Mrs. Griffith.
I don't really have anything to add, other than that I found the 678 number on a receipt. Will listed it as his own.
Does your husband have any reason to be threatening you?
Evan slaps a palm to the desk and leans in.
Her husband is dead, Detective. Remember?
She doesn't take her eyes off me.
Does he?
Absolutely not.
And you're sure your husband was on that plane?
It's neither a question nor a statement, but somewhere in between.
You're absolutely positive.
I want to spring over this lady's pristine desk, grab her by the ears, and kiss her full on the mouth. Because, no, I'm not positive. I've not been positive since the very second Mom called before Liberty Air did. What if it wasn't a blunder but confusion because Will was behind a computer somewhere, hacking his name onto that passenger mail?